The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Monday the 1st of September. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, thousands of people have left New Orleans as the extreme winds of Hurricane Gustav head towards the city.
It's going to be a really bad situation in New Orleans, and it could even be a repeat scenario of what happened with Katrina, at least as far as the weather goes. So I think that people should definitely get out of the city as fast as possible.
Despite the storm and thoughts of cancellation, the Republican National Convention begins today in Minneapolis. And the weekend's developments in Shropshire as the search continues for businessman Christopher Foster and his daughter.
With the change on Sunday and the formal identification of Jill Foster's body, the line of inquiry has now changed from that of an arson attack to that of a murder inquiry.
That's all coming up, but first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The Republican convention in the United States has been toned down for its opening day as Hurricane Gustav makes landfall on the southern states. Hundreds of thousands have left New Orleans on the instruction of the mayor. President Bush has gone to Texas to watch the relief operation. More on this later in Guardian Daily. In India, more than a million people are homeless because of floods in the northern state of Bihar. The authorities say they're struggling to get aid to people, and there are reports of villagers hijacking rescue boats and food being looted. The Home Office believe there will be an increase in crime, extremism and racism because of the economic slump. That's the message in a leaked letter from the Home Secretary Jackie Smith. She expects an increase in support for the far right and racism, as well as support for radical Islamist groups. She also expects an increase in property crime. European leaders are holding an emergency meeting in Brussels to discuss the crisis over Georgia. Gordon Brown told The Observer that he wanted a tough response to the Russians, such as freezing their membership of the G8 economic group. Other members have talked of sanctions, but Russia's warned that could be worse for Europe as they control oil and gas supplies. In sport, two surprises in international team preparations. Michael Owen has been left out of the England football team this week in favour of Jimmy Bullard of Fulham, while Ian Poulter's beaten Darren Clarke into the Ryder Cup golf team. Those are the stories leading the back pages of the papers, with The Mirror and The Mail suggesting that this may mean the end of Owen's international career. The Guardian, Mail and Telegraph put the fear of crime rising with the economy going down on their front pages. As The Mail puts it, credit crunch will send crime soaring. The Independent and The Times choose the American hurricane for their lead story, with The Indy asking about New Orleans, second time unlucky. More on the day's stories plus breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
New Orleans has been bracing itself for the arrival of Hurricane Gustav, with streams of vehicles leaving the city throughout the weekend. Although the storm was not expected to be as severe as Hurricane Katrina 3 years ago, it does look like being one of the worst the city has experienced, with the mayor advising people in no uncertain terms to get out. Authorities are working hard to make sure there's no repeat of the chaos and loss of life of Katrina. Here's a reminder of what happened back then.
Oh. These trees are coming down any second. There it is again! Look at that!
Well, that was from video taken by TornadoVideos.net, a company that chases storms and films them. I asked one of their team, storm chaser and meteorologist Reed Timmer, what he expects from Hurricane Gustav.
We chased Hurricane Katrina a few years ago, and then they were putting people in the Superdome, which we thought was a big mistake. It just seemed like people weren't taking that storm as seriously. And then the response wasn't big enough. It wasn't even close to being prepared for a storm of that magnitude. But it appears that Mayor Nagin is asking everybody to leave, and they're taking this storm a lot more serious, and they've begun evacuations. It looks like this track is one of the worst-case scenarios for New Orleans. With a landfall just to the west of New Orleans, the wind will be a direction where it will maximize the storm surge and the flooding in the city.
So tell me, when is landfall expected?
Landfall is expected Monday morning to afternoon right now. The storm is accelerating slightly, so it could even be Monday morning.
And how do you think it will compare with Katrina?
Well, this storm is a little bit different. Katrina was a Category 5 for a few days before landfall, and it weakened just before it made landfall to Category 3. But because it weakened at the last second, it still had a Category 5 storm surge, which is the ocean water that's piled up by, you know, the days of Category 5 wind. But this storm, it had issues passing over Cuba, so it weakened slightly. Now it's a Category 3, but it still could intensify to a weak Category 4 before making landfall. So the storm surge will not be quite as large as Katrina was. It still could be, because it still could intensify to Category 5 strength. But it looks like right now a slightly lesser storm surge, but the winds could be stronger than Katrina as it makes landfall. And also, the track of this storm right now looks to be a worst-case scenario for New Orleans. Katrina was a little bit to the right of New Orleans, but this one's actually a little bit further west, so there could even be a higher storm surge in the city of New Orleans from this storm.
So you don't think there's any sense in which the people of New Orleans are over-preparing with this mass evacuation and so on because of what happened last time and the rather embarrassing situation that the authorities were left in?
Definitely not. People cannot take this storm too seriously. I think they need to get out of New Orleans immediately. There's going to be a massive storm surge, probably 12 to 16 feet, maybe higher, and the winds will likely gust well over 100 miles per hour. It's going to be a really bad situation in New Orleans, and it could even be a repeat scenario of what happened with Katrina, at least as far as the weather goes. So I think that people should definitely get out of the city as fast as possible.
And how wide an area will the storm affect? Will parts of Texas be affected too, do you think?
Texas should be okay unless the hurricane makes a drastic left turn. There will be some outer bands and maybe some gusty winds, but probably nothing more than tropical force at the very worst for Texas. But most of the coastline of Louisiana will feel the effects of Gustav, potentially hurricane force winds. And eastward into the Mississippi coastline as well, they could also experience hurricane conditions. But there's still slight uncertainty in the track. It could go, you know, further left and further right along the Louisiana coastline. But right now, it's really getting narrowed down to the area southwest of New Orleans.
And as a company that chases storms and chases and videos extreme weather conditions, you have a team on its way down there. What will they be doing?
Well, we have a team that's heading down towards New Iberia, which is southwest of New Orleans. And they'll be streaming live video to our website so people will be aware of the conditions going on under the storm and at ground zero when it's making landfall. We have this 300-pound probe that we normally deploy in tornadoes, but it's designed to stay on the ground and the tornado will pass over and we can get wind speed and direction measurements and also video of inside the tornado, but we'll also be using this for the hurricane. And they'll be taking footage and basically trying to share what goes on as a storm like Gustav makes landfall.
How does your team make sure it stays safe?
We basically scout out the area before the storm makes landfall and try to find a really sturdy structure like a parking garage or a very large hotel, and then we'll park downwind of that. And we'll also have topographic maps to make sure we're not in an area that's too low so we won't get trapped by flooding. Because when we chased Katrina a few years ago, we actually took a Honda Civic down there, which is a very small car, and the waters were so high, up to 15 feet in height, that it actually submerged our vehicle and trapped us down there. And we had to ride out by fishing boat and then to an elevated highway, and then from there we hitchhiked back to Oklahoma. And we don't want a repeat experience like that.
And that was Reed Timmer of TornadoVideos.net. And The Observer's David Smith is in New Orleans and describes the scene there ahead of the storm's arrival.
One of extreme quiet, actually. It's like from one of those science fiction films, sort of post-apocalypse, where there's kind of the last man on Earth. You walk around New Orleans and it's extremely eerie. There are bars and shops which would normally have, you know, hundreds of people, and they're quiet, closed. The doors are locked. Some of them even have music playing or lights on, but there's nothing going on. And really, wherever you walk, you just glimpse the occasional person, and many of those are American television journalists. But there's no real semblance of normal life going on. And, I mean, the same goes for the Ninth Ward, which many people remember was worst hit last time, and there were literally, you know, bodies floating in the water when the worst flooding occurred, and again there, very, very few people around, few stragglers hammering bits of wood over their windows and doors and then leaving, just one or two people defiantly saying that they're going to stick around even though they may well be flooded again.
Observer writer David Smith. Well, even before making landfall, the storm had its impact on the National Convention of the Republican Party, which begins today in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota. The White House announced that President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney would not attend. President Bush, heavily criticized for his administration's painfully slow response to Hurricane Katrina, will instead be in Texas to oversee emergency efforts. Republican candidate John McCain himself visited Mississippi on Sunday to see preparations there. He even considered cancelling the convention. But before all this happened, John McCain announced Sarah Palin, the little-known governor of Alaska, as his vice presidential running mate, a selection that surprised political observers. Here now is The Guardian's U.S. election team with their thoughts.
Michael Tomasky, editor of Guardian America. A change of plan. The Republicans have canceled the first night of their convention because of the hurricane down along the Gulf Coast. A lot of speculation politically about whether or not this is a good thing for them. I think on balance it's probably destined to be a bad thing for them, because a convention is the one chance a party has every 4 years to showcase its case for why it should hold the White House. And if you don't have that chance, then obviously you've been hurt a little bit. Also, the Republican Party, in its last couple of conventions, has made a very strong case against the other person. And I expected this convention to be 4 nights of pretty merciless abuse directed at Barack Obama. So my thinking is every hour that they can't spend doing that about Barack Obama actually kind of probably benefits Barack Obama.
Ewan McCaskill, U.S. Bureau Chief. Well, the main absentees are George Bush and Dick Cheney. They were due to kick off the convention. The absence of George Bush and Cheney, who are pretty unpopular, maybe not as unpopular among Republicans as they are with the general population, but anything that allows McCain to avoid being linked too overtly with Bush is maybe no bad thing.
Richard Adams, Communist Free America. Part of me thinks that there is an element of this which does play into the Democrats' hands in a way, because the Democrats have a platform talking about how important government is and that government can do things. And one of the things you're seeing on your TV screens is government whirring into action and evacuating people and trying to fix the situation. And that, I've got to think, helps Democrats.
I'm looking forward to seeing Sarah Palin. It was interesting to hear John McCain trying to defend her, saying that she's got lots of experience. She's commander-in-chief of the National Guard in Alaska, and she's been abroad. She's been to Kuwait. If that's the extent of her foreign policy experience, God help America.
I think the mood on Sarah Palin is pretty skeptical and pretty grim in every quadrant except among very serious right-to-lifers, very serious social conservatives. Certainly among conservatives who are more concerned about foreign policy, among mainstream media figures, among moderate voters and among liberals, there's far more skepticism than enthusiasm. So she has a very simple job: demonstrate that she's not a lightweight, but I don't know that she can do it, because by all appearances, she does seem to be a lightweight.
I'm looking forward to seeing McCain make a speech. He'll be compared directly to Obama, probably unfavorably. Maybe he'll have to try something to slightly different, some sort of gimmick, maybe a satellite feed from New Orleans, but he'll need something like that.
Oh, it's neither make nor break. I mean, as always with any convention, he could make some sort of horrendous error, and that would hurt him. But the way things are going, I don't think it's really going to make much difference. And I have to say, I don't think his choice of vice president makes any difference. If you're on the losing side, nobody remembers who your vice president was. It doesn't make any difference.
Our team in Minneapolis there, and of course there's plenty more on the convention on our website at guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, scientist and environmentalist James Lovelock on why fixing the planet is like 19th century medicine. That's at guardian.co.uk/environment. At guardian.co.uk/football, follow all the last-minute deals with our live coverage of the transfer deadline today. And at guardian.co.uk/books, debut author Andrew Davidson talks to Alison Flood about Burns' medieval mystics and million-dollar publishing deals. Police investigating the devastating fire at the home of businessman Christopher Foster in Shropshire confirmed on Sunday that one of two bodies found in the ruins was that of his wife, Gillian. A male body and a gun were also found, and there is as yet no sign of the couple's daughter, 15-year-old Kirsty. Our reporter on the scene, Gemma Boland, has more on the police investigation.
Well, obviously, at the moment, with the change on Sunday and the formal identification of Jill Foster's body, the line of inquiry has now changed from that of an arson attack to that of a murder inquiry.
And another body was found with Jill Foster's body. What are police saying about that?
At the moment, the body which was found was that of a male. They have not formally identified him, but Superintendent Gary Higgins did confirm today that they will be carrying out further tests on that second body to reveal whether it is indeed that of Christopher Foster.
And did he give any indication of how long that might take?
At the moment, they don't know. They're working on dental records. They will be carrying out DNA testing on that second body to indeed establish if it is Jill Foster's husband, Christopher Foster.
And as yet, there's no sign of the daughter?
At the moment, there is no sign whatsoever of Kirsty Foster. Police continue to search the house, despite having to withdraw over the weekend on Saturday. They did go back in on Sunday, and they will continue to search the property. They expect that the search of the main house, where the two bodies were found, will continue to take days, possibly maybe weeks, just because of the state that Osbaston House is in at the moment. There's lots of falling debris. It's very difficult for officers to get in there. And as I say, it's just going to take time to really do a thorough search of that building.
What's the mood in the local community?
On Sunday, there was a service held at the local church, St John's. Part of the community turned up to kind of honour the family. There were special prayers held for them, and the mood there was particularly sombre. A retired priest was drafted in to say a service, because the community normally has their service in the next village, Knockin, which is a service particularly for children, because the mood is so dark. They didn't want the children to be exposed to any of this. They moved it to another church, and you know, they said it was a very dark time at the moment, that people were confused, and that people really needed somewhere to go to reflect on what had happened in the village.
The Fosters had only lived in that house for a few years, so did they actually know many people in the local community?
That is proving to be a problem at the moment. There doesn't seem to be many people who knew them very well. You know, everybody says it was a friendly community, that people said hello to them, that they were very involved with their horses and people would see them with their horse boxes. But there's no real feeling that anyone really knew the Fosters, the family, you know, what kind of life they led. Everyone said that, you know, there is a good community here, but every house is so spread out. There's only 200 people in this village of Maysbrook. You know, everyone seems to have said that they kept themselves to themselves.
That was Gemma Boland in Maysbrook. Still to come on Guardian Daily, a historic concert in Liverpool with Scouser Simon Rattle in charge.
Frankly, the minute I get off the train and hear the accent, I'm sold. You know, 1 hour, and I'm I'm gone.
But first, at one time or another, we all become victims of bad science, says doctor and author Ben Goldacre. Whether it's via the media or the information on the packaging of cosmetics or foods, we're almost bound to be misled or confused by what we're told. Dr. Goldacre, who writes a column called Bad Science in The Guardian, today publishes a book by the same name, examining the claims of those who may be trying to sell us quack health products, services and cosmetics. The Guardian's Alok Jha talked to Ben Goldacre about his new book.
Mainly it's a popular science book about epidemiology and evidence-based medicine. It astonishes me that nobody's ever written one before. If you look at all of the science coverage in national mainstream newspapers, you find that about half of it is about health, and Most of that is about the evidence on what will kill or cure you. You know, the Daily Mail's kind of ongoing Sisyphean mythical task of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world really into the ones that will either cause or cure cancer. So this is something that people are very interested in. But there's never once been in the Science Museum an exhibit about evidence-based medicine, despite the fact that it's the applied science that's probably saved more lives in the past 50 years than any other. It's not taught in schools. And that struck me as being an extraordinary disparity that leaves the field open for a lot of very misleading claims to be made.
And it's a confusing world. I mean, it's all there's statistics in there. There's all sorts of claim and counterclaim, which is the seam that you've been mining in the column for a few years.
Yeah, but actually, what's really useful about quackery as a way of teaching evidence-based medicine is that the errors that they make are very simple and straightforward. So the book, I like to fantasise, follows a kind of natural crescendo where we start off looking at how the evidence on homeopathy has been distorted and misrepresented and how you do a trial, because obviously homeopathy is basically the perfect teaching case for doing a randomised control trial. It is a pill that seems to perform better than a sugar pill, and the whole process of critically appraising scientific literature in medicine is all about trying not to get caught out and making that error. And then we sort of go up through the nutrition and the $50 billion food supplement pill industry until we're ready to take on the $600 billion pharmaceutical industry, which gets a pretty round kicking, I'm very pleased to be able to say.
We kind of go on ad nauseum in pieces we write too about homeopathy, and in our blogs we get quite good responses to point out that, you know, there's no evidence base and so on and so on. What is it that you've talked about in this book? I mean, are you trying to explain to people how a medicine gets approved effectively, how it's proved to work?
To me, homeopathy is only really a teaching device. I mean, you've got to think about why homeopathy is interesting. And
the reason I ask that is because you can kind of imagine, well, look, it's an easy target, isn't it, homeopathy?
Yeah. I mean, the whole purpose of talking about homeopathy is because, as I said, it's a good, clean teaching case for learning about evidence-based medicine. And it's the perfect opportunity because you'll find homeopaths quoting trials which have really basic flaws, things like, you know, no blinding or inadequate randomization. You also see them sort of misquoting and misrepresenting meta-analyses and systematic reviews of scientific literature, and it's the perfect way to talk about that. And obviously homeopaths also make themselves funny by behaving very badly when their ideas are questioned, and that makes them funny, which is a sweetener on the cake. But really, you know, it's a way of getting from A to B to me. I mean, in my kind of day job, I do things like, you know, teach medical students and doctors about critically appraising clinical trial methodology. And I think it's important to be able to take the really kind of difficult ideas of critically appraising pharmaceutical trial methodology, where they're trying to kind of bluff and pull the wool over the eyes of doctors who are trained and taught to spot methodological flaws in scientific evidence and claims that are being made to them. I think it's really important to be able to translate some of that into everyday lay language, and that's only doable if you start off with an easy example, and you know, homeopathy is that.
That was Ben Goldacre talking to Alok Jha, and you can also hear a lively discussion with Ben Goldacre in Science Weekly when he's pressed on his comments about science and the media. You can download the Science Weekly podcast later today from guardian.co.uk/science.
Guardian Daily from guardian.co.uk.
Liverpool will be welcoming back one of its favourite sons this week. Sir Simon Rattle is returning from Berlin to hold a concert that will be one of the highlights of the city's stint as European capital of culture. His appearance in Liverpool has been likened to a homecoming performance by Michael Owen or Paul McCartney. Simon Rattle himself expects it to be quite a moment. He talked to Ed Valiami about the excitement of bringing the Berlin Philharmonic to his hometown.
You don't like Liverpool. You either loathe it or you love it. Actually, I don't know anyone who doesn't love it. Certainly who comes from it.
Yes.
No, it's fantastic. But frankly, the minute I get off the train and hear the accent, I'm sold. You know, 1 hour, and I'm...
Yes, exactly.
I'm gone.
Yes.
And it's nice to see it in such a renaissance. There was some really rough time in Liverpool.
Yeah.
After the riots around then, the Derek Hatton years. But it was a very depressed place. Yeah, it's kind of cleaned itself up wonderfully. It looks very alive. But no, Liverpool, it's still... Well, look, it just is always going to be itself, isn't it?
Yes. I was watching a programme in preparation for this last night, actually,
with a professor at Liverpool University, the Pro Vice Chancellor, saying that it's a city that somehow sort of it looks seawards. It turns its back. Well, we'll get to Birmingham in a minute, but it slightly has its back to the rest of the country. It's special in that.
Well, they call themselves smoked Irish, don't they? Have you?
Yes.
No, it's off the side of the known universe. Liverpool always was.
Yeah, and going back, I mean, everybody wants that concert to be special for this reason, the prom for that reason, Birmingham, obviously, if we went back there. But just before we leave these two concerts, is it going to be something to stand on the podium?
Oh, good God, yes. I mean, of course, with the Berliners, I mean, that will be an amazing moment. But in a weird way, maybe even more with the Phil.
Yeah.
And to go, I mean, one thing I decided to do was to conduct the very first piece I conducted with them, the Sibelius Fifth.
Right, yeah.
Which I might have conducted almost more than any other symphony in the years in between. And that would be a very, very special moment. And if you're sentimental as I am in buckets...
Yes.
It's going to be quite a moment.
Ed Valiami talking to Simon Rattle, and that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Sonia Rothwell and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.